dramatised events. Characters and letters in this series were inspired by true stories from known historical facts and archive. A Story of Irish Whiskey: How Three Families Saved Irish Whiskey from Extinction. On Easter Monday 1916, a group of Irish nationalists proclaimed the establishment of the Irish Republic, staging a rebellion against the British government in Ireland. The rebels seized prominent buildings in Dublin, including Jameson Distillery at Bow Street.
Bloody Sinn Féin rebels.
Yeah, Irish fenian scum. Getting ideas about themselves. Patting up these bloody barricades.
They've only gone and took over Jameson Distillery as well as the GPO.
They'll be hammered, so. Shouldn't be hard for us to get through, then.
They'll be hell to pay.
It was the weekend, it was the Easter holidays, so very, very luckily, there really weren't too many people working on site, and there was only very much a skeleton crew.
Archivist Carol Quinn explains how Jameson dealt with this challenge.
The volunteers came in, they took control very quickly and without any bloodshed, and they set up a headquarters in the office of the chairman at the time, and that was Andrew Jameson, and that became the headquarters. They had taken over the distillery for its strategic location. And in fact, in the malt houses further up on Bow Street, there were snipers placed because they give you a great view over the surrounding houses.
And above all, not a drop of whiskey is to be touched. Nothing, do you hear?
Soldiers are we, whose lives are pledged to Ireland. Some have come from a land beyond the wave, sworn to be free, no more of ancient Ireland. So share.
And these were very idealistic young men. They were visionary, you know, but they weren't always incredibly practical. And one of the things that became very apparent was they barricaded themselves in, but they hadn't brought any food. So this was going to be a problem. So you actually had family members coming down to the barricades and trying to hand over bread, you know, trying to get food in. And the other thing that they hadn't realised was that within the distillery there were stables and there were horses. And the horses needed looking after. And they were getting hungry as well. And they started bellowing, you know, for their feed. And the volunteers could see all this grain lying around. And they didn't know what was the grain for distilling and what was the oats for feeding the horses. And in the streets outside were actually the stablemen and the grooms. And they could hear the horses bellowing with hunger. So they went up to the gates and they knocked and they asked permission to come in and just to feed the horses. And they were the only distillery employees left back in. So they fed the horses. So the volunteers were there and they weren't just in control of a distillery. They were sitting on almost 1 million gallons of raw spirit. And Bow Street is nestled very much into the Smithfield community. There's houses all around. If that had gone up, it wouldn't have been just an industrial accident. It would have been devastation. So the volunteers were very careful about this. And there was no random, you know, throwing of grenades or anything like that. I think some of us, we don't really take into account what a traumatic event the Rising was in Dublin. You had soldiers tearing down the streets around the distillery, looking randomly for men to shoot them, for no other reason but to shoot them. You had doors of family homes being kicked in. You had fathers being dragged out and shot, being beaten up. There was blood on the streets. It was incredibly traumatic. So people were barricaded inside of their homes. There was murder happening in the street. It was a really traumatic event. And it was traumatic for the employees of the distillery because they lived in the streets around. So when the volunteers barricaded themselves in Bow Street, they actually put barricades at the top and at the bottom of the street as well, because it was almost like a channel down to the river so that the British soldiers could use it as a way to get into the centre of Dublin. So although they barricaded the soldiers out, they barricaded a lot of the citizens in as well. And the other thing, they didn't touch a drop of the mature whiskey. And the last thing they wanted for the British Army to be able to say is that there were drunkards. They were operating under great strain, and one thing they did find in Andrew Jameson's office, they found his private stash of cigars, and they smoked them. And, you know, who could blame them? And it's funny, afterwards, when there was reparations for damages done, he put in his bill, you know, for these 200 Cuban cigars. And one of the volunteers, a man called John S. O'Connor, who had been interned subsequently in Frongoc, he wrote to Andrew Jameson apologising, you know, for taking the cigars, but saying they were the finest I've ever had. And Andrew Jameson wrote back and said,
"Dear Mr. O'Connor, I was grateful to receive your letter of May 2nd. I do not blame you in the slightest for smoking my cigars. Should I have found myself in your situation, I believe I would have done no different. I'm glad you enjoyed them, for they were bought to be smoked on special occasions. Faithfully yours, Andrew Jameson."
There was lovely human elements to it as well, but it was such a pivotal moment, you know, in terms of the Irish psyche, and the distillery was a witness to it. And the rebels held the distillery for over a week, and for a further period there was martial law, and that meant no employees, no workers could get access for a fortnight. Now at this period, the norm would be that if you didn't turn up for work, you weren't paid. And this struck home with me a few years ago. I was visiting Southampton and there was a monument there to the Titanic. And from the minute the Titanic went down, the wages of the staff who worked there were stopped. So all the chambermaids, all the boiler stokers, the cleaners, the people working below decks, they didn't even have the dignity after their death of being allowed to pass on a full week's wages to their survivors. That really stayed with me. So when I look at the wage books for Easter 1916 and the week after, I was really, really proud to see that written in pencil, "Rebellion in Dublin, all employees paid full week." The Jamesons realised that people were suffering enough. This was a traumatic enough experience without having their wages stopped. So while they couldn't come into work, they were all paid in full.
Revolution and war was bad enough for Irish whiskey. But the introduction of prohibition in the US in 1919 cut off an important international market for 12 years. But more damagingly, ruined Irish whiskey's reputation, which was much more difficult to recover from.
"Irish whiskey still for sale here. Arrived by special delivery yesterday.
2 glasses, straight up. This is an unexpected treat. I'd expected prohibition had ceased all imports."
"Ah, we'll find a way to keep serving our customers' favorite spirits.
Cheers, cheers. This is disgusting. Get me some water here.
Irish whiskey has a bit of fire in it.
This is rancid hooch."
Unfortunately, 1919 was famous for a second blow, and that's when legislation establishing prohibition in America comes into force. Now, it came into law in 1920. Overnight, all exports to America are stopped. But for Jameson and for some of the other Irish distillers, this wasn't a killer blow, really, you know. Yes, they exported to America, but, you know, they were exporting to Australia, to New Zealand, to India, to Canada. So they could take this hit. What they couldn't take, however, was the dent in reputation that Prohibition caused. So as soon as Prohibition was enacted, you had the rise of the moonshiner. The bathtub distillers, if you like, these were people distilling illegally under the radar. The quality of what they produced was pretty low. They weren't really selling to a very discerning audience. They were selling to people who were just desperate to get their hands on some alcohol. And of course, they wanted to maximize their profits. And the American customer had been used to paying a more premium price for a premium product, Irish whiskey. So the moonshiners, when they first came up with their rot gut, they in fact called it Irish whiskey so that they could charge more. And you begin to hear then things like, oh, I don't like Irish whiskey. It's very fiery. It's very burny. But people weren't drinking the real thing, which had a much smoother taste profile. And you get a dent in reputation. And that's what Prohibition does to Irish whiskey. It gives you a dent in reputation, something that the Irish distillers had been so careful to guard against.
Although repealed in 1931, it was a case of out of the frying pan and into the fire, as Ireland's new Taoiseach, Éamon de Valera, began an economic trade war with Britain, resulting in heavy tariffs being placed on Irish goods, including whiskey. Scottish distillers began to cash in, particularly in the US, and Irish whiskey watched, powerless, as its once global standing began to shatter and fall.
From Andrew Jemison, Dublin, to Edith Roosevelt. Dear Edith, I thank you for your welcome and delightful correspondence, news and Christmas wishes. I know Teddy's passing does not become easier as the years pass, especially at Christmas, but no dear Teddy is remembered fondly, and the good times we've all shared together live on in our memories. These are challenging times for our family distillery, but we are still in business, at least for now, and that is something for which to be truly grateful. We have endured years of restriction on our exports, which were our lifeblood. But still we move into the new year fearlessly, as those have done before us, hoping and believing the situation will improve. We cannot control these circumstances we have found ourselves in, but we can control how we react to them. With warm appreciation of your sympathy for our situation and understanding, cordially yours, Andrew Jemison.
From a product that was considered, you know, one of the world's greatest drinks and was sold in the 1880s, 1890s all over the world, you've it shrunk back down to the domestic market, and they are struggling. Now, they're still all family-owned. They've shrunk, not in size, because the buildings can't shrink, but in terms of their output, in terms of how many people they can employ, and also in terms of what they can buy from the farmers around. So there's a lot, there's a whole community struggling here.
It's one thing to have a bad year, even two, but 40 of them, how do you deal with that? On the next episode of A Story of Irish Whiskey, how three families saved Irish whiskey from extinction. Dublin and Cork whiskey rivalries are finally buried.
If we make the wrong decision, then we jeopardise everything we've been working
Despite the misgivings of Cork's patriarchal figure, Mr. Norbert Murphy.
Mr. Norbert, you're looking at me suspiciously.
I realised what a huge undertaking they'd agreed to.
We need to think about this carefully.
They realised if they were to ever get back to where they had been, they needed to put all the effort behind one brand.
A Story of Irish Whiskey is produced by lastcastmedia.com for Irish distillers, with special thanks to our interviewees for their contributions to the series, in particular those at the Middleton and Bow Street distilleries. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. And for more information on Irish whiskey, go to irishdistillers.ie.